We'll get that. I think we're ready to summarize a few things this morning. Let me see if I... I'd like to highlight just some of the fundamental claims of the politics of hope as we've been reflecting on during Lent. So we'll, as we hit Easter today, we'll end this conversation. But I want to summarize some of the key things about the politics of hope and see where it leads us. But before we get there, let's take a moment to hear our ministry theme for the year one more time. And this week, let's go ahead and share together whatever it is that we are hearing in this passage. It's familiar to us, right? We know all the words. We've heard them multiple times. But now, after we've reflected together for a while, after we've spent Lent thinking about the politics of death versus the politics of resurrection, let's now share and see what we hear. Good morning, Lori.
Good morning.
So our verse is from 1 Peter 1:3. We've began with this verse every week, but we haven't shared back every week about it. So this week, finally, we will. So hear this passage and ask yourself what stands out to you. And let's just share for just a moment, just whatever we hear in this passage. By the way, I should say, and I try and lead with this every time we do one of these, I'm not looking for anything here. So if you're wondering, okay, what does the teacher want me to say? I'm nothing. I'm not looking for anything. I just want to hear what we hear in this ministry theme. Whether it's related to what we've been talking about or not, doesn't matter. How are you hearing this passage? By God's great mercy, God has given us a new birth into a living hope through the resurrection of Jesus Christ from the dead. By God's great mercy, God has given us a new birth into a living hope through the resurrection of Jesus Christ from the dead. Okay. Let's share aloud whatever stands out to us in this passage for whatever reason, a word, a phrase, a thought, something that excites you, troubles you, whatever the case may be. And Brian has a mic, and now we have a mic over here as well. But let's start with Wendy.
I on the way to church, we were listening to Keith Green's the Easter song.
Uh-huh.
And one of the lines in it is, "Hear the bells ringing, they're singing, we can be born again."
Yes.
And I love the connection of resurrection and new birth.
Yes.
That was lovely.
It is nice. It's nice to remember that resurrection, which can feel like a technical term almost, is actually new life, new birth. We are all eager for new life and new birth. We are all eager to say, I can be born again. It's still possible to be born again, and so can everyone around me, which is hard to believe sometimes. But it's exciting to hear it and be reminded of it once again. By the way, I love it that as you were driving in, we were singing those very words in this auditorium, and we will sing them again later in the service. So that was lovely. Okay, Kevin, and then Lisa.
Living hope stood out to me, not wishful thinking.
Oh, right.
But more...
Yes, okay, so Kevin was saying a living hope stood out to him, not wishful thinking. There is at times a place where you're in such a state that all you can do is wish. You just wish. This is not what Peter is talking about. He's saying something was born again. It is living now. Your hope is built on that new life that has actually already come. Not wishful thinking, but this active participation in the new birth that's already arrived to some degree. Yeah, thanks. Good. Lisa, I think, was next. I don't know where the mics are now, so Lisa, then Jen.
I already said this a few weeks ago, I feel like, when we started, but living hope really stands out to me, that it is something that is
growing and needs tending like a gardener. And
oh,
it's our
right.
responsibility and just the wonderfulness of nurturing our own hope. Hmm. Like, there's a responsibility in how we continue having hope. Like, we can nurture that.
Right. Oh, what a beautiful sentiment. And fits so well with Jesus being mistaken, but maybe not mistaken, for a gardener this morning who tends to things that are living. If it's a hope that's living, that's active, it must be tended to like every other living thing, from a plant to a child, must be tended to. What a beautiful thought. Thanks, Jen.
I heard a second chance at a new way of living.
Mm. Yes, right. New birth, second chance. There's always possibility, there's always opportunity for second chance at a new way of living. That's a good reminder. Okay, where are we at? Michael, and then Ryan, and then Carrie.
We've heard a lot from, about individual adjectives, like great and new. And
okay,
living.
Yeah.
I'm just struck by the repetition and the rhythm of you have great mercy, new birth, living hope. It's like each of the nouns are emphasized.
Yes.
These extra adjectives. And there's something that brings the stress a little bit more by having that rhythmic of each one being modified that way.
Right. Oh, yeah. There's a real poetry to it. You know, it's interesting. I once heard Stephen King say, stop using so many adjectives, writers. If you want to learn one trick, his one comment was, writers, stop using so many adjectives. And then he says right after that, until you have to say what you need to say, right? So don't do it unless you really have to. And Peter, great, new, living, right? These things to really say what he needed to say. Linda, then Ryan.
So I don't know quite why this popped into my head. Well, so I was talking with Dawson yesterday, and this conversation reminded me he's getting ready to graduate here in a couple of days, and he was talking about this, that he's entering this new phase of life and this era of excitement and anxiety and all the stuff that comes with now I'm like a real life adult. And this verse, what showed up for me was, we have in our rhythm of life these markers of transition or newness that happens, whether it's adolescence and actual birth and adulthood and, these big moments that we often think of as like a new chance or a new start. And this verse is saying you don't have to wait for those. Every day can be a sacred new whatever. Yeah. Every day can be that moment where you decide this is going to be the time when I'm entering into something new. I don't have to wait for a college graduation or to turn 18 or to, enter menopause or whatever it is, right? Like we don't have to follow the earthly. Sorry, maybe that's
yes,
just
yeah.
me. But that, it can be any day because God has given us the thing that is the greatest moment that we can just live into at any moment.
Yeah, I love that sentiment. We don't have the same tense in English that the Greek language has called the perfect tense, which is a present action with continuing effect, and it can happen now. It's something that happened in the past. It happens now. It will happen in the future, but you needn't wait. It's present right here. Lovely sentiment. And if Dawson figures out what it means to be a real adult, have him let me know. Yeah. Okay, Ryan?
I was thinking how there's a reversal of the natural order of things. We're born, and then we die, but here there's death. And then there's birth.
Oh, what a lovely sentiment. It's like when the Beatitudes are called sometimes the great reversal. They flip everything upside down. It doesn't make sense. The meek are blessed? What are you talking about, right? It's the opposite of the way it works in the world, it seems. And this does that same thing. We're born and then we die. Everyone says that. You're born and then you die. This says you die and then you live. What a lovely sentiment. Okay, Carrie or Dan or Carrie?
I was in here listening to the worship team practice.
Yeah.
And I was just looking at that verse thinking, man, that's like one of those songs, that starts really, really quiet, God's great mercy,
doing this new birth, doing living hope.
Yes.
Doing the resurrection, you know, and it's just
phew. Right. Oh, that's good. I love that. Connecting with Michael's thoughts, sort of the way it sort of builds up into something, resurrection from the dead.
Yeah.
That's lovely. Dan, then Bob, then Kay. Oh, Dan, then Kay.
This might be taking too much privilege with the scripture, but I heard it as God gives new birth, something in the present, and it's continuous. It's not, I got it, now it's over. It's continually. New birth, new birth, new birth, new birth.
Right. Oh, that's a great thought. Dan, you reminded me of one of my professors one time said, everyone asks the question, does God exist? The much better question is, do you exist? You know, God is existence. Do you participate in it? Do you receive each and every moment from God who sustains you, new birth? Which is similar to sort of what you're hearing there. That's lovely. Okay?
It has struck me that the resurrection is simply a matter of hope. And several years ago, Jeff Dethridge led prayer during communion, and it was on Easter, and he said, God, be with us in our faith, because we don't know anybody that's been risen from the dead. And that really helped me to realize, in a sort of sad way, that if you can't convey that to somebody else, then they won't accept the resurrection. And that's sad for me, for other people, but grateful that I recognize that through just prayer that it is a matter of faith, a big matter of faith.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a good sentiment. You know, it's interesting, when we read our gospel reading today, the beloved disciple, as he's named, but John will believe, but not understand, because he's never known anyone who was raised from the dead before, right? So it takes this degree of faith that is just beyond what humans could probably offer themselves. And yet sometimes the grace of God offers it. Yeah, thanks. Okay, was there anyone else who had a comment about this passage? Hello, white family. Okay, thanks for the reflections on that. This passage is rich, and of course we'll continue to return to it all year, but this will be the last time we return to it in this particular class about the politics of hope. So, with those thoughts in mind, and I think it all leads in well to this, here's what I want to offer up as just some sort of fundamental claims about the politics of hope. We've just been reflecting together, what is the politics of hope in comparison to the politics of death? Remember, we started off with politics that builds its life around the story of Prometheus or Sisyphus, modernity or postmodernity, and all of them had in common a collusion with death in some way. What's the alternative? And we named it the politics of hope, and here's a couple things I want to say about it. And in the midst of this, if you have comments or thoughts, feel free. We can still dialogue together. But here's just a bit of a summary of what we've said. Perhaps the single most important thing to say, and I'll try and highlight why it's the single most important thing, but perhaps the most important thing to say will be this about the politics of hope. And that is, the church is the politics of hope. Now, here's why this is significant, and this is a sort of a summary of what we've been trying to reflect on here. Whenever you say politics, or if someone says to you, I want to talk about politics, what comes to mind for you? I am guessing something along the lines of Democrats, Republicans, and nation states, right? That's natural. And I don't mean to say there's anything wrong with that. Of course that's what comes to mind. The difficulty is, when Jesus shares his ministry with us, and the church rises out of the grave with him in resurrection, the church is meant to be an alternative politics to the politics on offer in our world. Not to say the church does it well all the time. Clearly not. Clearly not. That's why we have confession built into every single service. But the church was meant to be this alternative politics. But somehow along the line, probably at the time of Constantine when church and empire merged together, somehow along the line, church became not a politics any longer, but just something personal to you in your own heart. Which, there's nothing wrong with your faith being something personal to you in your own heart, of course. That's essential. But somehow that was separated from, divorced from, cut off from the fact that faith was meant to be an entire politics of its own that was an alternative to the politics of death all around us. And over the years, we lost that more and more, and then the individualism of the Enlightenment for all the good that it brought us, right? Human rights and all that, that's all good. But with the individualism that was so prominent in our modern culture, it even became further separated from a politics, such that faith was constantly thought of accepting Jesus in your heart, whatever that means. I mean, it probably means something good, right? But I'm not even 100% sure what that means. Accepting Jesus in my heart, I think I want to do that, but I don't even know what that means, really. And the reason I struggle with it is when Jesus was walking around, and then when he died and was resurrected, and then the church rises up with him, it was an entire way of organizing life. Remember our definition of politics? Politics, simply put, is just the way you organize a community. That's it. The way you organize a community. And when we forget that, then the church doesn't become a politics at all. And if someone says, hey, I want to talk about politics, we immediately think, oh, we want to talk about nation states. Because if we want to talk about the church, that would be something personal and private, something other than politics. So all of this class has meant to lead up to this claim. Where is the politics of hope? You are the politics of hope. Where's the politics of America? We see it all around us. Where's the politics of Egypt? We see it in the nation state of Egypt. Where's the politics of hope? It's meant to be this transnational, transgender, so to speak, right? All genders, all peoples, all nationalities, all ethnicities. It's this trans-global unity of what Peter refers to as a holy nation, a people belonging to God, but just we don't have borders. We are the politics of hope. Where is it? Here, in the church. So, okay, that's the first fundamental claim. I'm belaboring it enough, I think. And so the main difference between the politics of hope and many of the other politics we have available to us in this world, the main difference is this. The other politics are in some sense in collusion with death. The politics of hope is meant to be in collusion with life and resurrection. What do I mean by in collusion with death? Something like this. Remember when we talked about Prometheus and modernity? It's this really strong optimism that said, you know what, I think we're actually going to overcome death someday. It was a naive, not taking death seriously enough. And so it colluded with death insofar as it didn't take death seriously. And so death continued to infect it because it didn't take it seriously enough. On the other hand, there was, if you remember, we talked about Sisyphus and postmodern politics. They colluded with death, believing death was ultimately victorious. And they tried to build their entire organization of a community around the claim that death is going to win in the end. Death's going to beat you all. Death is going to be victorious in this world. The politics of hope says just the opposite of both of those. It says death is significant. It is huge. It is perhaps the single most significant thing in the world. But it's not victorious. It has been defeated in the resurrection of Christ from the dead. If it has, what then should life look like? If that's true, what should the organization of our life look like? So, the church is the politics of hope. It's trying to collude with resurrection instead of colluding with death. Okay, so those are some summary thoughts. Let me say this as well. We talked just briefly about Christian nationalism. So this is just a summary. We didn't spend nearly enough time on it, and I'm not going to spend enough time on it this morning either. You know, we could do a whole nother conversation sometime about that. But let me just say in this context, one of the problems with Christian nationalism, just that sentiment. By the way, you should know, Americans don't have a monopoly on Christian nationalism, right? Christian nationalism has been a thing for like 1,700 years, right? It's forever been around. Again, probably with the rise of Constantine and the merging of empire and church, right? So Christian nationalism is not new, not by any means. But the problem every time it manifests itself, from Constantine until today, the problem every time it manifests itself, according to the politics of hope, is it confuses nation for church. The nation becomes the church. It becomes the politics we're most concerned about, that we believe God is most concerned about. And then you can understand, if in fact the nation is the thing God's most concerned about, well then, yeah, we got to do some things to make this nation turn out well. But if the politics of God is not the nation state, not any nation state, as useful as nation states are, of course, but not any nation state, of course, is God's politics, the church is God's politics. Christian nationalism confuses those two. It confuses the church for the nation. And then the nation becomes, well, you can see why it's problematic. The church is meant to be transglobal. No nation, by definition, can be transglobal. It's local. It defeats the very thing Christ came to do, which was to unite people, Jew or Greek, slave or free, rich or poor, male or female, right? It defeats that by focusing too closely on one nation that's not transglobal. The politics of God is universal. And the only thing that's universal in that sense, coming from Christ, is the church is meant to be universal. All those people committed to the way of life, not the way of death. So again, that's not nearly enough for Christian nationalism, but it was like the Jewish people, you remember reading about this in Scripture, the Jewish people who thought God chose the Jews for the sake of Israel. But what do the prophets continually tell the people of Israel? God chose the Jews for the sake of the world. Not for the sake of Israel, not for the sake of one nation, for the sake of the world. They were confusing their nation with God's politics. God's politics is bigger. The church is that transglobal politics. Again, constantly getting it wrong, constantly confessing, but that is the politics of God. Okay, so then the question becomes, so, okay, if the church is the politics of hope, what can I do to make a difference in this world? What can we do to make a difference politically in this world? You know, we're always wondering, what is it that I can do? What can we do? And here's sort of the second fundamental claim, and it's a strange one. I admit, it is a strange one. It might even strike you as wrong, but maybe receive it and see what you think. Here's the second claim the politics of hope makes. The church is God's politics. Second, what can I do? The politics of hope answers this. The first task of the church is to be the church. The first and primary task of the church is simply to be the church. So if you're wondering, what can I do in this world? How can I make a difference politically in this world? The politics of hope says the very first thing you need to do, be the church. What might that mean? What does it mean to be the church? Well, remember when we talked about all those things we do on Sundays?
But let's talk about it. We baptize people on Sunday.
To be the church is to be a people of baptism. What do we say in baptism? We say every stranger, no matter how strange, is welcome here to be part of this politics, this nation of people. Everyone, male or female, is welcome here equally. They're all one in Christ. Everyone, regardless of race or ethnicity, is welcome here. You're welcome to be one with this diverse people. What does it mean to be the church? Well, it means to be a people of baptism, where we just say no to racism every single time we find it. We say no to sexism everywhere we find it, right? We say no to all the other isms that keep us from being a trans-global politics. The first task of the church, what can you do? The first thing you can do, be a people of baptism who say, I'm not having any separation between me and other people. There's not going to be an us and them any longer. We're all one in Christ. So what can I do? How can I make a difference in the world? The first task of the church is to be the church. Be what we're called to be, which is massively difficult. A big enough task to spend the rest of our lives practicing. First task of the church is to be the church. What do we do on Sundays? We tithe. We share our money with one another freely, right? We say, I'm merely a steward of my bank account. I don't ultimately own it. I share it with you because you need it. The primary task of the church is to be a people who use money that way, all the time. Caring for one another, supporting one another. That's the primary task of the church. Not to solve American politics or Greek politics or Egyptian politics. I mean, as important as those are, that's not our primary task. Our primary task is to be the church, which of course is massively difficult and challenging. But it's God's politics. It is what we are called to. I wonder, can you think of any other examples of what it would mean to be the church? The primary task of the church is to be the church. Any other examples come to mind for you?
Can I ask a question?
Yeah, yeah. And it'd be helpful if you asked it in a microphone. And Brian has one. There we go.
Well, okay. My question is we're called to love everyone, even those that are evil. We're called to love everyone. Mm. But how do you go about fighting and battling evil? It's out there.
Right.
It's all consuming. It's a battle, like in Revelation.
Yeah.
There's a battle going on.
Right.
How do you fight that?
Yeah.
At the same time, love those people.
Right.
That you're called to love.
Right.
While you're battling this, because it can be quite overwhelming, that
yes.
evilness that is persistent.
Yes. Yes, so true. Massively overwhelming, despairingly overwhelming, that tragedy and evil and death are still part of our world, right? Absolutely. And so when we look to, you know, Paul talks about you mentioned Revelation, the battle with this, the principalities and powers of this world, right? How do you battle against them? And what does he say every time? Every single time, he points back to the way of the cross. Every single time, he says, how did Jesus respond to the tragedies, the evil, the pervasive death present in our world? He walked up to it and washed its feet. He loved it when they struck him on the face. He embraced and said, forgive them, when he nailed them to a cross. He is God. He is God. And you know what else he is? He's also fully human. He is the revelation of what God is like and the revelation of how humans are meant to be. Yeah, and absolutely, absolutely. Absolutely. Goes in, does the symbolic act of flipping over tables. He stands up. He speaks harshly to those who are abusing power. Absolutely. Right? Speaks strongly. And then washes feet. And then says, God forgive them. They don't know what they're doing. And then every time Paul says, okay, how do we battle against the principalities and powers of this world? By which he means evil and tragedy and death in this world. How do we fight that? And every time he says, we take up our cross. We take up our cross and follow Christ. And the world's going to say it's foolish and weak. You can't just love bad people. And yet somehow we take up our cross and follow Christ, and we discover it's divinely powerful. Somehow, Paul thinks, Jesus seemed to think, somehow we do all of these so-called weak and foolish things, and it actually transforms our world. We use the examples, of course, of what Gandhi did and what Martin Luther King Jr. did, right? Just because they're famous examples everyone knows off the top of their head.
I got another example.
And yeah, and everyone around him said this, foolish and weak, right? And somehow it transformed the world because it had the power of resurrection behind it. So there is a sense in which, yes, Christ did it, and Christ is God, and I'm not, absolutely. Which is why we need the whole church to do it together. Because when I do it poorly, you guys help me do it well. When I have trouble forgiving, you as a community help me forgive better, right? Which is why we need the politics. But the response to it seems to be this way that feels weak and foolish but has the power of the resurrection behind it. Ryan, what's your example?
Well, it's also what Star-Lord did in Guardians of the Galaxy. They joined hands and sang a song to defeat the big evil at the end.
Yes, yes. It reminds me of my favorite theological book ever is called Waiting for Godot in Sarajevo. And it's a book about Susan Sontag going over to Sarajevo in the midst of the war and pulling together a whole bunch of artists in the midst of a town that was crumbling and bombs were exploding everywhere. And they performed a play for the town in the middle of it. And everyone's like, what are you doing? And her response was, I think beauty is divinely powerful. So in the midst of war, I'm going to do what seems weak and foolish. I'm going to put a little beauty into the world and see what happens, right? It doesn't make sense. Like the cross doesn't make any sense. It doesn't. It doesn't make any sense to love your enemies and go to the cross. And somehow the power of the resurrection is behind it, and new life begins because Christ was willing to do so.
Let me say one more thing.
Yeah, absolutely.
But at that same time, there is a battle going on out there, and somebody has to fight that. It's just like in our world today, somebody has to fight a Putin. Somebody has to stand up to that.
Right.
And it takes, because of our technology, it takes a battle. It's ugly. And there's police out here that put their lives on the line because they're trying to help and save somebody from a gang or whatever it is that's going on.
Right. You know?
And those are tough positions to be in at the same time. See,
yeah.
Even in that example of having that play for those people, there's still that battle. Somebody has to be out there fighting that evil or those Putins or whatever
yes.
it is and what's going on in Myanmar. And somebody has to stand up and it becomes physical.
Yeah, it may.
And it's nasty.
It may, and in fact, part of what we want to say is.
Well, here, let me say one other
thing. Oh yeah,
thing.
Go ahead. Yeah.
And the with Jesus, it was the centurion that asked Jesus to heal his daughter, right?
Yeah.
And there's a man that's fights and has been in battle and it's serious stuff. Hmm. And they're doing it for a reason. You know, they've proven that genetically, people are better at fighting. They're genetically modified or whatever in their body. It makes them good at battle.
Mm-hmm.
They're good at that. They're good at fighting. And there's other people that don't have that gene, you know. And so it seems to me like there's people that we have to be thankful that they do. They're not just, you know, and they're Christians too. You know, look at Rob Quick has been in the police, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know, there's other people that are like that are good examples. But that's we're glad that we have people that do that and stand, because if they didn't, we wouldn't be able to put on those plays like she was able to do in Sarajevo.
Mm-hmm.
So somebody's gotta do that, it seems to me like.
Yeah. Thanks, Mark. I appreciate the comments and the way you articulate them. I appreciate the sentiments of it all. And no doubt there is a complexity. The key question that we'll want to ask is, someone has to stand up. Someone has to fight. The key question will be for us, what does it mean as a Christian, as a follower of Christ, to stand up? Certainly we must. What does it look like to stand up as Christ? And what does it mean to fight as Christ? And those are complex questions that I presume there are not easy, obvious answers to. But the constant question will be, what does it mean to do this like Christ? What does it mean to do it like the one who said, I'm willing to die for my enemy? What would that look like? And I suspect it would not look like, say, carpet bombing a city. Right? Like, it would not look like that. I think we can rule that out. It would not look like nuclear weapon. I think we rule that out. And yet, when you rule those things out, the politics of death immediately says, well, then you're just all going to die. All of you are going to be put to death. And the answer is, maybe. Maybe so. But we do not believe we are in control of making this world turn out right. We believe God's in control of that. And so, like Jesus, he reached a point where he said, Peter, put away your sword. Those who, you know, take the sword are going to die by the sword, and it'll be an ongoing cycle. What does the politics of hope look like instead? And Jesus said, there'll come a point where I'm willing just to die. And everyone says, well, that's stupid. That is stupid. And then he's raised from the dead. And it turns out it's not so stupid. Turns out it was more powerful than the sword that Peter was carrying. Somehow, this politics of hope stands up and fights against the ways of the politics of death, so that the politics of death does not become the ongoing cycle that this world experiences. Now, what that looks like in every particular circumstance is complex. I agree, complex and hard to figure out, and we'd have to spend a lot of time discerning, as we always do, about how we should respond. But we have to every time return to the claim, it must at least look like Christ. Whatever the answer is, it must at least look like Christ so that we can claim we are in fact the body of Christ on earth. That must be true. So anyway, thank you for the heart and the comments and the questions that emphasize the complexity of this. And let us remember constantly, it must look like Christ, whatever the answer is. Dan, what were you going to offer? Or someone else?
Well, I was going to say, so yes, Jesus washed the feet. Yes, Jesus went to the cross. And Jesus spoke truth over. So he flipped the tables. Yes, we have that example. But what we have a constant example is, mm-hmm. he spoke truth mm-hmm. over and over and over again. He said, you vipers, multiple times. He said, don't treat them like that over and over again.
Yeah.
Let these come to me. Over and over and over again. And so when I think about the examples, and when I think about my own life, and it gets complicated. It gets mm-hmm. complicated when part of my job is funded through SAMHSA, and I just got another list this week of what I can and cannot say, and I have very physical feelings about the harm that when I'm doing adult or youth mental health first aid, that we're no longer allowed to talk about the LGBTQ youth and the risk that that puts. And I'm like, that is going to kill people. If we take that out of mental health first aid, that will kill people. So I have to say, okay, for me, it's, I'll take out what I'm supposed to take out in the slides, but you're not going to stop me from speaking truth because I don't want youth to die. And so you're not going to control what I say. You can control what I put in print. And when I speak and I do my trainings, I'm going to talk about the reality of suicide amongst our LGBTQIA+ community. I'm going to talk about the families and how we need to love our children, how they ask to be loved, because I want to save lives. And so to me, that's my fight. And so for me, that's where I'm going to speak truth, and I'm going to have the data to back it up. And I can do that without picking up a sword. And to me, that's what I see as the politics of hope. I'm not a person, I don't believe in violence. I don't believe in death. But I will speak truth. Mm-hmm. And I've come to realize that might cost me my job. It's a very real possibility. And I'm willing to just continue to speak truth. Mm-hmm. And so that's the thing that I see washing the feet, but I also see speaking truth as love as well.
Mm-hmm. That's good. Thanks, Melinda. It's like when we talked about what do we do on Sunday. Every Sunday we have a proclamation because we believe somehow speaking truth is divinely powerful. I mean, it doesn't feel like it is. You can speak truth all you want. It feels like the world just keeps going on killing one another. It doesn't feel divinely powerful, but we claim through the power of the resurrection, speaking truth is divinely powerful. That is one way we stand up, and it is absolutely what Jesus did. In fact, he points to Herod and says, that fox, he did not mean that as a compliment, right? You know, he's saying, here's some truth about this man. And somehow that's divinely powerful, even though that fox continued on with his ways of death. And still washed his feet. Yeah, Dan?
I don't know if this is going to help or not, but I appreciate the struggle that you've talked about. I'd never call it a battle, and I'd never call it a fight.
Mm-hmm.
But I will call it a struggle.
Yeah.
Because I think fighting and violence is probably not the way of Christ. I don't know if Christ ever battled anybody. Mm-hmm. I don't know that he ever fought anybody. There seems to me in his actions that he accepted all, but that does not mean he condoned all.
Right.
And I think there's a real difference in those two things, mm-hmm. that we think that we've accepted a person, that we have to condone all their behaviors. The other is that I think evil is not an entity. I don't think it's a thing. I think it's an action. And I think that's where I get mixed up. Mm. I judge a person on their actions, and that's it. And I don't look below it. I try to not. I just leave it there on that surface. And he's bad, or she's bad, or mm-hmm. they're no good, or they're not right. I don't condone their actions, but I still need to accept them.
Yeah. Thanks. Those are lovely sentiments. It reminds me of that comment that there's a difference between your ontological nature and your ethical nature. I know we don't use the word ontological very much, but ontological just means the core of who you are, who you ultimately are. Your being is, in fact, good, a child of God. It sometimes, ethically, looks like the opposite of that, but it never changes who you are ultimately. I love that person, always. I do not condone that behavior, ever. That type of thing, that we see Jesus washing feet because you are a child of God, challenging your behavior because that doesn't match who you are as a human being, as a child of God. Let me offer this up. Thanks for those comments. Let me offer this. Here's another fundamental claim that the politics of hope is trying to make, and it relates exactly to everything we're saying here. Again, sort of fundamental to what the politics of hope is trying to suggest, and that is this. Faithfulness is more important than effectiveness. Now, the politics of death does not believe that, and therefore justifies doing whatever is necessary to be effective. The politics of hope, following Jesus, says, no, faithfulness is what we're going for here. And we'll trust God to make everything turn out correctly. We're not in charge of history. God is. So we'll be faithful, and for Jesus that meant, I'm willing to let my enemies kill me. That was the faithful answer, not the effective answer. It wasn't effective at all. He didn't stop Pilate by letting Pilate kill him, right? It wasn't effective at all. But it was the faithful answer. I will end this cycle of violence, allow myself to be killed, and then the power of the resurrection was behind it. He actually is victorious out of faithfulness, not effectiveness. And the idea there is that effectiveness allows you to justify so much behavior that you know doesn't look like Christ, but you think, we got to do it. We got to make the world turn out right. We got to stop all the bad guys. We got to make sure everything turns out the way we want it to turn out for good reasons, right? It sounds like I'm being sarcastic. I'm sorry. I mean that for good reasons we want it to turn out well, right? Absolutely. But then it allows us to justify so many things that look nothing like Christ and become the politics of death once again. And then we keep the cycle of the politics of death going over and over and over again. At some point, like Christ, we stop and we say, effectiveness, Making the world turn out right is simply not as important as faithfulness, looking like Christ, being the church. The first task of the church, be the church. Okay, kids are coming in, so let me finish. I think I might have one or two more. Oh yeah, okay, and so here's something you can take with you as you go about your everyday life, right? Here's one final thing. One final thing before the other final thing. Here's a question to ask. How can I bring about the kingdom in whatever task is before me? Let's say you're asking about Putin, right? How can I bring about the kingdom in that task before me? How is whatever I'm doing in response to Putin bringing about God's kingdom? How is, when I talk to these people in my trainings, how is my language bringing about the kingdom in this moment? That is a question everyone can ask as you want to practice the politics of hope. Every action, from writing poetry to washing dishes, how is the way that I'm doing this bringing about now, manifesting now, the kingdom that is to come? The claim was God is building God's future through your actions today. So the politics of hope is trying to build, by God's grace, the kingdom that is to come. In every action, how can I bring about the kingdom in whatever task before me? Okay, here's one thing we never got to. This will be the last thing, I promise. We never got to. Can a Christian be a senator? And the reason I was asking that is, if the church is the politics of hope, can Christians then participate in the politics of death? These other politics that are politics of death? Here's the short answer that the church has always offered. Yes, of course, so long as you do it as a Christian. Can Melinda work in her job? Yes, so long as you do it as a Christian. At some point, there may come a time where you can't do it because you can no longer be a Christian and do that job. Can you be a senator? Yes, of course. Can you be a police officer? Yes, of course. So long as you do it like Christ. So long as it looks like Christ. And there may well come a point where it doesn't. And at that point, faithfulness is more important than effectiveness. That's what the politics of hope claim. Okay, so all of this raises like 80 questions and answers too. So there's a lot we could talk about, and perhaps we'll continue conversations in the future. But thanks for your engagement. I hope it's helpful as we think about these things. Thanks for your engagement in all of this over the Lenten season, and we'll continue on with new stuff next week. All right, see y'all back in 4 minutes and 30 seconds.
'Tis risen
indeed. Thank you.
Morning.
Okay. Oh, wait.